Welcome to the Sports Law Biz Podcast, dedicated to helping people better understand the law and business of sports. I'm your host, Peter Ott, and we've got a lot to talk about here today, so why don't we just jump in? Hello, this is Peter Ott with the Sports Law Biz Podcast. I'm here today with Andy Schwartz, economist and managing partner at the economic consulting firm OSKR, a contributor for Vice Sports, and a blogger at Sports Geekonomics. Andy has been an expert witness in many court cases covering a variety of issues, including antitrust issues that touch sports. He's been a tireless advocate against the current NCAA structure. In addition to that, he's a great Twitter follow. So it's good to have you here with me today, Andy.
Thank you. And for those people who want to take you up on it, it's Andy HRE is my Twitter handle.
Okay. So before we get started, I don't know if there's anything else in particular you want to share about your background.
Well, I ended up becoming a sports economist somewhat accidentally. Like you said, I do antitrust economics, and that antitrust involves a decent amount of interface with the law. So you end up in a lot of cases, at least thinking you think like a lawyer, even if you don't. And one of my very, very early cases involved antitrust issues involved with the Raiders moving back from Los Angeles to Oakland. I live in Oakland or close to Oakland now anyway, and sort of stumbled into it. But it's a fun thing to stumble into because people are a lot more interested in asking me questions about sports antitrust law than price fixing of laptop batteries and things like that.
I imagine so. Yeah, well, thanks. Why don't we get started then? We're here today to talk about an article that you co-authored with Richard J. Vellante for the most recent edition of the Marquette Sports Law Review. It's entitled "The Ninth Circuit Decision in O'Bannon and the Fallacy of Fragile Demand." So I think a lot of people who listen to this podcast are familiar with the O'Bannon decision. Probably not as many are familiar with fragile demand, but I'm sure we'll get into that. Can you provide us kind of with a way to get up to speed with where the O'Bannon lawsuit is right now?
Sure, I'll do my best. Both sides have appealed the decision that was made at the Ninth Circuit to the Supreme Court. So that case is currently pending whether they'll accept it or not. The plaintiffs appealed saying that the Ninth Circuit's reduction of the district court's remedy misread the law. The NCAA is appealing the entirety of the decision, saying that the district court finding and the portions that were affirmed at the Ninth Circuit were wrong, at the same time saying that the portion that the Ninth Circuit reduced was perfect. They're in that weird spot of having to say that the Ninth Circuit was wrong and right. Some amicus briefs just got filed yesterday, actually, on behalf of the NCAA in their request. But I still think that there may be a request by the Supreme Court to get further briefs before they decide whether or not to take cert, because at least from my extremely amateur reading of the court right now, they're doing everything they can to avoid deciding things until they get a ninth member.
Okay. Just to summarize the ruling by the Ninth Circuit, they overruled the district court judge, which set a limit on an amount of compensation that athletes could receive. Is that correct?
Right. They affirmed the liability finding and they affirmed half of the remedy, but they overturned the other half of the remedy. The half that they affirmed was saying that any agreement by NCAA members to set a maximum payment below the full cost of attendance was unreasonable, but that anything above the full cost of attendance was not required.
Okay. So as an antitrust case, you know, this involves different schools coming together as the NCAA and saying what is the maximum amount of compensation that student athletes can receive, whether that's the full cost of attendance or something else. And under antitrust law, courts can set a minimum or a maximum amount of compensation that employers are allowed to collude to. Is that correct in some cases?
Gosh, it's hard for me to say yes to that. Generally speaking, it's against the law to collude on wages, say, or collude on prices. And in sports, the courts have recognized that the exact same conduct that would be per se illegal if it's two firms that manufacture products, like we are only going to play 162 games or, you know, 82 games, let's say basketball, since baseball has an antitrust exemption. That conduct outside of the sports conduct would be coordinating output and would be illegal. But there are some things that you're going to have to do if you're going to create a sport that are different. And so what that means is that almost everything gets thrown into the rule of reason, which in contrast to the per se rule says when you make a rule that looks collusive, you at least have the opportunity to justify why it's reasonable. And what ought to happen, I think, The court should be allowed to say, yes, that particular rule is reasonable because of X, Y, and Z. And so that would look like what you said, which is that the court would say it's okay to collude on that price. But it's really different, which is that it's not okay to collude on the price, except that you have shown that there are offsetting benefits that overturn it. And so I guess a way of looking at where we are in the Ninth Circuit is to say that what the district court judge, Judge Claudia Wilkins, said was that it wasn't okay to collude on the level of payment that was allowed prior to this case, and that you should pick a new number, and that that new number shouldn't be any lower than something like the full cost of attendance plus $5,000 a year in deferred additional compensation. And what the Ninth Circuit came in and said was, no, actually, that floor below which we can say it's not reasonable is just COA. And then they probably went one step further and said, and in fact, we'll tell you that anything above COA isn't necessary, which I kind of think, in my pretending I'm a lawyer, but I'm not one way, they just didn't have facts to be able to make that assessment, but they made it anyway. And I think that's some of the plaintiff's lawyer's appeal of that piece of the remedy.
Okay, so the NCAA will need to show that their limit, you know, cost of attendance or whatever, is reasonable in order to be upheld, because there's reasons to have all these restrictions in college sports in order to get sports to work, right? Is that correct?
If the Supreme Court only were to take the plaintiff's case, then that's exactly right, that the NCAA would need to show that the Ninth Circuit's splitting the baby decision was appropriate because COA, cost of attendance, is this sort of magical line. But in their affirmative appeal, that, if that's even the right way to put it, in the NCAA's own appeal, they've actually said, no, the court should have found that our rules are basically per se legal, that we as the NCAA can set any price, even below cost of attendance, and that we shouldn't be micromanaged by the courts.
Okay. So the NCAA basically is arguing that paying athletes, you know, above what they're currently paying would diminish college sports or perhaps even destroy college sports as they exist. Is that correct?
I think that that's a fair statement. The sentence that they like to focus on is that college sports would not exist if athletes were paid.
Okay. Because of amateurism. Amateurism would be eliminated. And that's what makes college sports college sports. Right. As the reasoning goes.
Sorry that it's hard for me to answer yes or no. It's like we're in a deposition. Sometimes the answer is because consumers won't watch if athletes receive more than some specified amount. And sometimes it's more tautological, which is that because college sports is amateur, if you stop making them amateurs, then college sports won't exist. Without really recognizing that that thing that would still exist would involve sports played by people in college. They just happen to get paid, as if that will be, you know, like banana instead of college sports. And so it's clearly something different because we're going to label it differently.
Right. And in the Ninth Circuit in O'Bannon, they talked about how untethering athlete compensation from education is a quantum leap and changes it drastically. You argue that this is wrong under the rule of reason. Right. Why is that?
Well, particularly, I think that what the majority did is something that courts have been doing, not just this court, but courts going back to right after the Board of Regents decision in 1984, which is confusing what the purpose of the rule of reason is with respect to an antitrust violation. The question, generally speaking, is, okay, you are imposing some sort of restraint on the market. And generally, we would say, no, you can't do that. But here we're going to allow you to justify why the pro-competitive benefits outweigh the anti-competitive benefits. And that pro-competitive benefit is supposed to be something along the lines of, and this is like, again, the language of the NCAA quotes, allows the product to exist or creates demand for the product, things like that. And instead of asking whether or not this level of pay would substantially impact consumer demand, what the majority in O'Bannon asked was, if you pay them, are they still amateurs? Which, again, is sort of a goofy question. It's like, well, probably not. It's certainly, if you define amateur as not receiving pay, then if you pay them, they're clearly not amateurs. But the question is, what does that have to do with competition in this market? Will that change the nature of demand? If it doesn't change the nature of demand because they're now paid and they're now therefore not amateur, kind of so what? It's like the same consumers are receiving the same benefits, and that's supposed to be what you offset the anti-competitive harm from in the rule of reason. It's not supposed to be, but let me give an example. Let's imagine that you and I decided that we wanted to sell our cars made by unpaid laborers,
okay,
right? And they're like, well, you're violating the minimum wage laws. And we're like, well, right, but we've defined our product as product made by unpaid laborers. And if you don't let us violate the minimum wage laws, then our product will cease to exist. Sure, the cars will be the same, but they won't be made by slaves anymore. And it's sort of tautological. And if consumers aren't buying the product, first of all, if the consumers are buying the product because it's made by people who aren't paid, that's sort of disturbing. But if they aren't in any way changing their purchase consumptions based on the wages of the employees of this car company, then it's hard to argue that that's central to the product, even if you call it that, even if you say it's Andy's unpaid labor car company. Yeah, sure, that's central to the name of the company, but it's not central to the core of demand. And I think that's really the difference, is that what the NCAA is arguing is that because we call it amateur, whether or not that matters to consumer demand doesn't matter. What matters is we can't produce the product the way we want to define it unless you let us fix prices. And so therefore, that justifies our fixing of prices, which strikes me as effectively turning the alleged bad act into its own justification. It seems very circular.
Okay. In comparison to the comparison that you drew about unpaid laborers making cars, you know, people argue college athletes are compensated, right? They receive an education, they get a scholarship. So it's not exactly the same as not paying somebody anything. How would you respond to that?
So if somebody said to me, that's completely different, college athletes are paid, I would agree. I think they get paid a decent amount. They get paid in kind in terms of tuition and fees. They get sometimes paid in kind, sometimes paid by check for room and board and books. And then in the most recent year, the NCAA rules changed, at least in part because of the O'Bannon case, so that now that athletes can also receive payments in cash for their cost of attendance. And depending on the school, that can be about a 35% increase in what they receive from the year before. Sometimes it's less. So the way I see that is it says, yeah, this is not amateur sports. This is price-fixed sports, that athletes are being paid a substantial amount now. So the idea that demand is driven by people only playing for the love of the game doesn't make any sense to me. That would be something like Division III, which is very unpopular in terms of television audience. And instead, what we have is people who are receiving compensation, but that compensation is fixed by common agreement among all competitors in the industry, which is what we call price-fixing.
Okay. So another argument in support of the NCAA is that it is necessary, you know, just for the sport to exist. So there has to be a body that sets standards, that sets, you know, limits on how the system works, and that's the role that the NCAA performs, and it sets those standards, which say, you know, the scholarships are set at this level. How would you respond to that?
Well, yes, generally speaking, sports need somebody to do certain things, like, for example, to tell the referees how to enforce the rules. But in football, for example, the NCAA doesn't do that. Each conference is able to hire its own referees, and we can have good ones or we can have Pac-12 referees. But the spot where that level of coordination occurs is often not at the NCAA level. And in particular, prior to World War II, the definition of what was an allowable scholarship was not set at the NCAA level. The NCAA said, you should be amateur, and then left it to every school and every conference to determine what that meant. And there was a wide variety of methods, including University of Pittsburgh paid their athletes. And other schools paid them, but paid them to do jobs on campus. Other schools didn't believe in scholarships at all. And yet, if you think about like when college football became an American phenomenon, I think of it as sort of the raccoon coat 1920s. That was in this period where there was no standardized level of compensation. And the first attempts to make standardized compensation was 1948, where the definition of what an allowed scholarship was zero. It didn't work because the schools refused to follow that rule. They tried again in 1956, and that did work. It was set at something similar to the scholarship we have today, where it was room, board, tuition, fees, and some sort of living stipend. But right at that point, 1956, is also when college lost its place of primacy to the NFL in football and to the NBA in basketball, where those professional sports zoomed ahead of college, which to that point had been the predominant way that people watched and listened to. You know, the radio was much bigger than sports. It was college sports. And I can't say that that's a causal connection, but I do think that the moment that caps got put in, limiting how much colleges could offer talent, that the talent in the pros went up.
Okay, and at the very least, you know, not having caps wouldn't reduce the demand for the sport to zero.
Well, Let's just say that it did, and this is really getting at the essence of the article that Ricky Vellante and I wrote. Let's imagine a world where it did. Who would be the first school to offer a penny more than its consumers? If it was really like a crazy demand function like that, where you can pay them a half scholarship, no problem. You can pay them a full scholarship, no problem. You can pay them a full scholarship and a cost of living stipend, which is what's going on now. And we saw that change, and we saw no change in demand from 2 years ago to 1 year ago. Fine. But if you give them a dollar more, it'll come crashing down to zero. What idiot is going to offer a dollar more? Like, and everyone knows, of course, that if schools could offer more for a five-star athlete, they would. We all know that's because our fans will like it better, not worse. If we knew that the arena or the stadium would go from full to empty, that just strikes me as the oddest business decision. And the way what Ricky and I talked about this is imagine if you were an NFL team and you found out that if you installed spikes onto every seat so that it was really uncomfortable to sit at the arena, but it would cost you some money to do it. Who would do that? Like, what kind of firm would do that? But that's effectively what this theory posits about paying the athletes, that it has the effect on demand, just like putting spikes in the seat. People will stop wanting to sit at the games if they know the players are paid, and it's more costly. So let's see, I'm a manager. I could raise the cost of producing my product and lower demand. That doesn't sound like a very wise move. And so what I think we all know is that, in fact, in reality, that those managers running those teams, we might call them athletic directors, they actually know that by making this investment in quality, by paying better players or trying to attract better talent by paying, that they think that their consumers will actually like it more. And it really reveals, in some sense, the fallacy that is baked into the argument that if you pay players, no one will come. It really should be said, if no one will come, then no one will pay players.
Okay. And then, not even thinking of it as a legal issue or as an economic issue, but more just kind of from a fan perspective, I can already imagine people listening to this podcast thinking, well, if schools are allowed to pay athletes at market rates, some schools are going to be able to pay athletes more than other schools. And that's a problem because then some schools will get far behind in the quality of athletes they attract
Like,
just because they don't have money, right?
right. I mean, like, so right now, Kent State is able to beat Alabama for most of the football talent, but if the Alabama could pay, they'll start winning those recruiting battles.
Okay, so that's the response is that imbalance already exists, right?
That's right. So if you think about it, a football team has the ability to generate revenue in Alabama and at Kent State. And generally speaking, the Alabama demand function, the demand in Tuscaloosa to watch football is a lot higher than in, I guess, Kent State is in Kent. And so what's happening is that the talent is going where it's most valued now. And because Alabama is unable to do the normal thing that companies do when they have customers that will reward that talent more, which is to share more of those profits with the talent, so that, Google pays people more than corner stores pay people, because Google can make more money off of that coding talent than the corner store can. Alabama can't do that. So one thing is they pay their coaches a lot more, because if I'm a player and I can't get paid, well, at least I can get better coaching. So that serves as a substitute to draw in the better talent. They put waterfalls in the locker room because, well, I can't get paid, but at least I can have a really swank locker room with an Xbox and an indoor waterfall rather than a crappy facility at Kent State. And so that we see all of these investments that creates alternative ways of attracting talent. But the underlying reality is that the reason the talent is gravitating to Tuscaloosa and to Austin and to, LA to play for USC is because that's where the most demand is. And so the people who are meeting that demand are doing everything they can to get the talent to the customers. And all we'll be switching is how they spend that money. Instead of paying a construction firm to build an unnecessary practice facility, there will be more of a directing of that money to the athletes.
Okay. And so I think the crux of the article is that paying athletes more than they're currently compensated won't eliminate the demand for college athletics. And even if it did reduce it in some way, the economic incentives exist in that schools wouldn't pay more than they rationally would want to do economically. Is that correct?
That's right. I mean, one thing to recognize is that there are in football, 130 FBS schools. In basketball, there are 351 D1 schools. And there's a great deal of diversity now in terms of the overall academic and dorm offerings that are being made. And schools in the America East are not competing with schools in the ACC for basketball talent. So there's a great deal of separation. How do I say this? There's a pecking order. The fact that we are able to call five conferences the Power Five and they're the same five conferences and that we don't expect that to change from year to year shows that we recognize that there are different levels of demand for talent and that the schools with the highest demand for that talent, which means that their customers ultimately have it, will make the biggest offers and will get the best talent, generally speaking. And there's always exceptions. Someone's dad is the coach at Creighton. And so a talent that might be above Creighton's spot in the pecking order will end up there and you get a McDermott. But those are quirky things in any market that generally speaking, you'll see the talent line up. And that to the extent to which there is an actual aversion by consumers out there such that paying less will generate more demand, you'll never see a firm pay more. And if it's a heterogeneous market where some people are totally fine with paying more, and some people are totally against it. We have markets like that all the time, and that markets will sort itself out. And the school that will make the most money because of fans who love paid athletes and want to have the most talent regardless of pay, they'll do that. And the school that will make the most money by being as amateur as possible, they'll go that direction. And, you know, we sort of see that now. We see that because not every school has chosen to be in FBS. Sometimes they're in FCS. Sometimes they play D3 football. And, you know, markets exist to deal with heterogeneous demand. On the other hand, if there's homogeneous demand, if everyone's the same and everyone hates paid players, you will never see it. You don't need a rule. We don't need a rule to stop people from jumping to the moon because it's impossible. And it's just as impossible to imagine a company investing, not knowingly investing in an expensive thing that hurts demand.
Okay. Well, yeah, I think that's very clear. And I think people might have their own moral feelings about paying college athletes or whatever, but I think the economic argument, it seems pretty clear. So
yeah, I guess the other thing to say is that, you know, it's perfectly fine for an individual firm in an industry to have a moral stance to say, we want to, let's say, you know, let's flip it around. We want to pay more than minimum wage because we think that's the right thing to do. But when that firm goes to all of its other competitors and says, you should do it too, we're going to form a cartel, even a cartel to raise wages, that's against the law. And so if Notre Dame doesn't want to pay its athletes, great. But the moment Notre Dame tells USC how much to pay, that's where I draw the line. I think every school should act its conscience. And what the NCAA does is it imposes one school's conscience on another school. That's the big difference.
Okay. Well, yeah, no, thanks for talking with us today. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before we wrap things up?
No, thanks very much for having me on. I hope people found it interesting.
Okay, I think they will. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This has been an episode of the Sports Law Biz podcast. This podcast is available through the Sports Law Biz website or through iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and YouTube. Before wrapping things up, I'd like to thank some people. First of all, I'd like to thank my friend, Lieb Montoya, designing the Sports Law Biz podcast logo, as well as the Sports Law Biz blog logo. His artistic ability certainly surpasses mine. If interested, you can check out more of Lieb's work on Instagram and Twitter. His handle is @LiebMontoya in both places. That's @LIBMontoya. Additionally, I'd like to thank the musical artist for providing this theme music that you're listening to right now. The artist is a band called The Losers. The album is entitled Young, Tough, Terrible. The track is Sports with an exclamation point. The label is Needle Drop Co. This music is available through a Creative Commons license of Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported. This podcast was produced and recorded by myself, Peter Ott, and you can reach me at my personal Twitter handle, @PeterJOTT. Through the Sports Law Biz Twitter handle, @SportsLawBiz, or through email at sportslawbizblog@gmail.com. Any feedback is greatly appreciated. If you are interested in contributing to either the Sports Law Biz blog or podcast, definitely reach out to me. I love to talk to people about these issues, and I can use all the help I can get. Finally, I'd like to thank you for listening to this podcast. Hopefully it was enjoyable. If so, please spread the word and let your friends and colleagues know about it. Leave a review on iTunes. Any way you can spread the news about this podcast would be greatly appreciated. That's our episode today. Tune in next time to learn more about the law and business of sports. I'm looking forward to discussing it with you on the Sports Law Biz podcast.